Today I'm speaking to Sarah Olney, the Liberal Democrat MP for Richmond Park and North Kingston, and you're also the party's business spokesperson. Welcome back to Radio Jackie, Sarah. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for having me. Nice to speak to you again.
Thank you. Let's go first to the terminally ill end of life bill that passed in the Commons by 23 votes. I know you had your reservations and your concerns regarding safeguards. You cited vulnerable adults, especially those with eating disorders, and say you've had many emails from concerned constituents. Can you highlight a few of these examples?
Well, obviously, constituents share their thoughts with me in confidence, but I can certainly say more broadly, I've been very engaged with this bill. I sat on the bill committee, so I went through it line by line. I heard a lot of the oral evidence. I read all the written evidence, which, you know, amounted to many, many hundreds of pages. So I've had a great deal of time to consider all of the impacts of this bill. And I think with vulnerable adults in particular, I think the big issue is about how we assess capacity. And we talk about capacity in terms of, do people have the capacity to make a decision of this kind? And it's right there at the beginning of the bill that people have to make this decision freely, without coercion. There are a lot of people who lack capacity. They might have learning difficulties. They might have a mental disability of some kind. There's a piece of legislation called the Mental Capacity Act 2005, which is used throughout the healthcare service as a way of assessing capacity. But a lot of people have expressed doubts that is the right way to assess capacity in relation to this particular decision. And the Royal College of Psychiatrists in particular have said that they do not think that the Mental Capacity Act is sufficient for this purpose. And yet that is what it says in the legislation. So at third reading, which we had in the chamber on the 20th of June, I said very clearly, I don't think we should be passing this piece of legislation if the Royal College of Psychiatrists, who have a specific role to play in assessing applications for assisted dying, are not happy with this legislation, then we shouldn't pass it. But obviously, as you said, my particular concerns around that were not heeded by the majority of my colleagues, and the bill has now passed the third reading in the Commons, and it now goes to the Lords. We're not sure when it will be considered by the Lords, but it has now progressed to the next stage.
It's interesting. Wes Streeting said that legalised assisted dying would take NHS money away from medical treatment for the living. Are there many GPs in your constituency concerned about what their role could be in this bill?
I haven't had GPs contact me directly about that, and I haven't raised the subject with them up until now. Obviously, it's been a private member's bill. It's been a matter of conscience for MPs. But now that it is passed its Commons third reading, it remains to be seen what the Lords do with it. But I think we do now have to start thinking about, well, how exactly is this going to be implemented? And it is one of the big unexplored issues still related to this bill. Is it going to be delivered by the NHS? And there are many who are working within the NHS who object to that because they think it goes contrary to the NHS's established objectives. But if it is going to be delivered through the NHS, then how is it going to be funded? It's not an existing service. So will money have to be taken from other existing services in order to fund it? Or will the NHS be given extra budget? In which case, where is that budget coming from? I think there's a lot that the government now have to think through. Keir Starmer, in response to Wes Streeting, has been very clear that he wants this to be delivered. And I'm keen to hear from the Prime Minister at the earliest possible opportunity what he thinks about how this should be funded and how it should be operated. But there's still quite a lot of debate to be had around this. But interestingly, there will be no further debate in the Commons. The MPs will have no further opportunity to debate this. There will be no further votes on this. And the bill will automatically come into force 4 years from royal assent. So Parliament have no further role to play in how assisted dying is implemented, even though we have this very, very major issue of exactly how it's going to be delivered and funded, still undecided.
You mentioned a royal commission. I mean, that would be a very expensive process, but how would that work?
I would be in favour. What I said before it passed third reading was that I do think we need to take, if people, and for people who want assisted dying, who are supportive of the concept, I actually think it would be much better to have taken a lot of this decision-making away from MPs and asked the Royal College of Psychiatrists, the Royal College of GPs, the other Big bodies that represent, all the different parts of the medical profession and the legal profession, to have this debate amongst themselves about how they think this could best be provided, what safeguards were needed, with their own experience of dealing with vulnerable people, with people at the end of life, with people, who are struggling with these decisions, but also just to protect their rights as professionals. It's MPs, I think, are imposing now on professionals a responsibility that they specifically don't want, particularly in the case of the psychiatrists, for example, to manage these very, very complex and difficult provision. So, and I think it would have been better to have consulted extensively with all of those professionals before we actually got to the stage of framing the legislation, so that we would know that when we were debating the legislation, it was around the decisions that are then political decisions around how it should be funded, around what sort of priority we should give to this, but knowing that we were debating a form of provision that the professionals required would be happy to provide. And that's what I think has been really lacking.
Right. Well, moving on, you recently debated that London was shortchanged in the spending review. You cited concerns about Hammersmith Bridge as one of them. Do you think Hammersmith Bridge is going to lose out on funding with the spending review?
Oh, I am still chasing ministers to get a solid answer on Hammersmith Bridge. I asked in Department for Transport questions last week and I haven't had a solid answer. So, yes, I still very much fear, but there's a little bit of me that remains hopeful. The government have been announcing a lot of new infrastructure spending over the last few weeks, big £1 billion structure fund for specifically, they said, bridges, but not specifically enough. They haven't yet told me whether Hammersmith Bridge will be one of them. But I think more broadly, London does look like it's going to miss out under the spending review. There weren't the commitments that I know the Mayor of London was asking for around things like the extension of the Docklands Light Railway or the Bakerloo Line, which are big infrastructure projects that we know could unlock so much extra housing, so much more public services that would benefit London as a whole. And those commitments haven't been made, which is extremely frustrating. So the spending review, and it hasn't allocated our local councils, our local boroughs here in Richmond and in Kingston, the sort of funding that they really need to keep pace with the demands on their finances. There's a fair funding review also announced last week in addition to that, which looks as if it might allocate even more funding away from London and towards areas with greater deprivation. And I'm not arguing with that as a policy, but I think there are quite severe issues with consistently underfunding London. And you have to consider, child poverty in London as a whole is 35% of all children compared to 29% across the UK as a whole. So we are really, despite the fact that London is the economic powerhouse of the UK, there are still very many issues here in London itself that urgently need addressing. And the government are not yet stepping up to the plate and really giving London what it needs.
Still on the issue of funding, funding for the Royal Parks police teams. I noticed recently there were gangs in Bushey Park stealing bicycles. If we lose a Royal Parks police team, this is only going to get worse, isn't it? How are we with this? Have they actually said they definitely are going to cut the Royal Parks police?
They have now, despite campaigning by myself, Manira Wilson in Twickenham and many, many people across both Kingston and Richmond boroughs, they have now said that they will be cutting the Royal Parks Police from the 1st of November. I've had conversations with Mark Rowley about this. But the Met are facing a £260 million shortfall. And they're going to have to cut 1,700 officers. So I think it's going to be enormously problematic for my constituency if we don't have the Royal Parks Police, if they're going to try and cover the work that the Royal Parks did from our existing neighbourhood forces who are already very, very stretched. But when you look at the funding shortfall across the Met as a whole, I can sort of understand why they felt forced to make that decision. But again, it comes back to, and I have been pushing the Home Secretary on this, as well as the Chancellor. I have really wanted, I just think it's so important that London gets the funding that it needs to maintain the policing that we really need.
Yes. So moving on, you've called on the government to reverse its increase of the bus cap from £2 to £3. What are the main concerns for businesses and everyday commuters in your area in the light of also the ongoing district line disruptions?
Oh, the district line. I know. I think problems with the district line, and this is just me speculating, but they do seem to intensify when the weather gets warmer. I think it's, it's ongoing. And it's been particularly bad recently. I have spoken to people at TfL. I've spoken to people at Network Rail who are responsible for the line. And a lot of it, actually, when I say because of the weather getting warmer, that we've certainly seen in recent weeks an increase in the number of fires. And I think, again, that's probably a direct impact of the weather. I know that Network Rail are looking for several resolutions, use of flame retardant liquids, for example, and that they are, you know, really pushing forward with some of their, problem solving around this. I think they're doing all they can, but we've got a lot of very, very outdated infrastructure, particularly around the District Line and the North London Line, or the Mild May Line, as I should now call it. But yes, I'm pressing Network Rail for solutions, and I know that they're doing their best.
Super. Can you tell me how you're helping constituents that have been impacted by the TfL again, licensing delays because they had a cyber attack? How are your constituents in Richmond and Kingston being affected by this?
Well, the cyber attack, I mean, your listeners will know, was quite a few months ago now, but the ongoing impact of that cyber attack has meant that TfL have not been renewing licenses for minicab drivers and taxi drivers because their computer systems have been impacted. And these huge delays have had a really, really massive impact on some of my constituents. They have suffered extreme hardship because they haven't been able to work. I've got a driver in my constituency who was made homeless along with his young daughter. Another constituent actually died while he was waiting for his license to be renewed. And I do think that the delay, because he hadn't had an income for several months, and that may well have contributed towards his death. So it's been really, really serious. And I've been really disappointed in the mayor's response. He has not responded to me when I've raised these issues with him. Gareth Roberts, who's the GLA member for Kingston, Richmond and Hounslow, raised it in mayoral questions last month. But the mayor is now taking this seriously. He's looking into resolving the delays. There's going to be compensation, I'm really pleased to hear, from people who've been impacted. But it's taken them many, many months to get round to dealing with this issue. And I'm really disappointed that they haven't been a bit more responsive on this. And I've had a lot of different correspondence on this. It's been a really major issue.
Lots to work on there for you. So, weekend, it was good to see people in and out of the water in Teddington objecting to the direct river abstraction known as the TDRA, the so-called sewage pump. Hot weather was obviously a good way to cool down, but it's also a good way to make their points of view about this proposal. Can you tell me about the public consultation which launched on Monday and is till the 26th of August? Because why do you think it's so bad, and what is a better alternative? And do you think the consultation will be listened to, or is it just Thames Water going through a process?
So I think the first thing to say is proposal is for extracting some of the fresh water from the Thames at Teddington, piping it up to the River Lee, and then sort of backfilling, if you like, with treated sewage. I think it's really important to say it's treated. It is, you know, reasonably, it's high quality water. It's not raw sewage being pumped into the river. And I think the Green Party in particular have been a bit inaccurate in some of the things that they've been saying about that. However, there remain real concerns about the quality of the water that's going to be pumped into the Thames at Teddington, which is obviously Ham on my side of the river, particularly the PFA chemicals and the health consequences that can be caused by PFAs. We haven't had enough research into that, and that's something that's really, really concerning, because we've got a lot of people who use that stretch of the river for rowing, for canoeing, and also for swimming, and it's a really, really You know, and as you say, even just paddling on a very warm day like we've had recently. So, you know, it's a part of the river that people are using and that people are getting into, and they really, really appreciate that they can use the river at that stretch for those reasons. So very concerned about what the environmental impacts of pumping the treated water into the river is going to be. Firstly, as you say, the consultation is now open, and I really, really want as many of your listeners who are able to respond to that consultation to make sure that their voices are heard. I do think, actually, because this proposal has been in the pipeline, but no pun intended, it's been in the pipeline for quite a while, and Thames Water have already made a number of modifications to how the proposal will impact on the land, particularly across Hamlands, and that is in direct response to public pressure. So it is really helpful, and they do listen, you know, and change can be affected if people really speak up and make their voices heard on this. So I think it is really important that as many people as possible respond. As far as alternatives are concerned, you know, this is a major, major capital investment. It's going to be about, you know, somewhere between £400 and £500 million of capital expenditure, and I think they're talking about this at a time when we still see so many leakages right across the network, and this impacts time and again in my constituency. We've had major leaks on Kingston Hill, in Manor Circus in Richmond, which created, you know, and it always creates massive traffic chaos whenever this happens. So I really want to see Thames Water make a real commitment to upgrading the pipe network before they're going through these massive sort of these huge projects. And they've done huge projects on this scale before, and they haven't been effective in terms of securing our future water supply. So I think there are many other alternatives that they could be investigating before committing money to this scheme.
And will the people, when they respond to the consultation, will they see what chemicals are going? You talk about PFAs. Would they be aware of what's going in the water to make possibly their own judgments? Because we don't know what they're doing to the biodiversity of the river, do we, really, when they're putting treated sewage, what's it's treated with, and that sort of issue.
Exactly. And I think that's my biggest concern about this, is that the environmental impact of doing this is not yet known. And pumping it into the Thames, the impact it will have, I mean, obviously the human impact and the many people who are using the river for recreation activities at that point is a huge concern, but much bigger concern, what does it do to the very sensitive, you know, plant and animal and marine life? And, you know, Hamlands, as many of your listeners will know, is a nature reserve, and there are some you know, very uncommon plants in that particular habitat, and we should be doing everything we possibly can to protecting flora and fauna on that stretch of the river. And we really don't have enough information about what this kind of putting this kind of treated sewage into the river at that point, what kind of impact that's going to have.
Well, we'll have to wait to see on that one. I'll let you go soon, but finally, can we just mention the welfare bill debate? The bill is now not a welfare and pit bill, it's just a pit bill. Ed Davies cited damage to unpaid carers and the families they look after, and he's mentioned a reasonable amendment that the Liberal Democrats are suggesting around fixing the NHS and social care. Can you briefly sort of explain what that's all about?
Yes, of course. So the Welfare and PIP Bill passed second reading in the Commons last night. It's actually now just a welfare bill. There is now no longer any PIP in it, in the Welfare and PIP Bill, because they removed that clause that addressed personal independence payments at the very last minute. So the whole thing has been an absolute, you know, horror show, frankly. And it kind of remains to be seen now what this will mean, not just for you know, the benefit system in the future, but frankly also the Labour government. The Liberal Democrats had a reasoned amendment which we laid didn't get voted on last night, although we think it should have been, which was basically saying we're not going to vote for this at second reading because it doesn't address many of the areas of concern. Now, our concerns always around the personal independence payments. Those are payments that are made to disabled people to help them meet the costs of You know, the additional costs that they experience in their life because of their disability. And it makes no sense if your aim is to enable more disabled people to work to remove PIP, because it, you know, if they can't meet the costs of their disability, then they can't go to work. So so we felt that, you know, removing PIP was always at odds with what the stated object of the legislation was. Now, Ed Davey, as many of your listeners know, is very dedicated to the issue of standing up for carers. He's a carer himself, as many people will know, with his son John. He he's really anxious about the impact that this bill will have on people who are not working because they're having to take time out from the workforce to care for family members, you know, disabled children or older people, and other people with disabilities. And the amount of carers allowance that people receive is really pitiful and nowhere near enough. And there's been a scandal recently about how people have been penalised because they've, you know, sometimes their earnings take them over the threshold at which they should be claiming carers allowance. And then you know, the DWP tried to claw it back. So he's been very, very active on behalf of carers, and we want to see the government go a lot further to make life easier for carers who tend to find themselves spending so long battling the system to make sure that they get everything that they need and that the person they care for is entitled to. So whenever you have, you know, big changes to the welfare system like the government are proposing, it makes life harder, and it's actually putting up barriers in to stop people looking for work, and that's something that obviously the Liberal Democrats will always fight against.
I think we could talk about this one for absolutely ages, about, you know, online forms saying how easy it is to fill in a PIP, who are really entitled to a PIP. There are people that maybe not be entitled to a PIP. It's such a broad subject which we could chat about for ages. Maybe we'll leave that for next time. But I'll let you go now. I've got a news bulletin to do. So thank you so much, Sarah, for coming on to Radio Jackie again. As always, it's a great pleasure to talk to you, and have a good afternoon.
And you. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Bye.